Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. And again, I'd like to thank all the people who helped chip in last week's fundraising drive. Really helped me out a lot, and I appreciate it far more than you know. Also, I write for antiwar.com. You can find the archives of my articles there. Our next guest is Philip Giraldi. He writes for the American Conservative magazine, available at amconmag.com, amconmag.com. He is a former DIA and CIA officer, counterterrorism in the CIA. He's now a partner in Canestraro Associates, and he writes something called the Intelligence Brief. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Giraldi.
Yes, hello.
It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
And I should say, everybody, you know, you can't just go trust in former CIA agents and everything that they say, but Ray McGovern says this guy's the real deal. Anyway, I'm just poking fun because, after all, if you were still CIA, you wouldn't admit it anyway, right? So what's the point?
That's for sure. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so, and as far as officialdom and what you can tell me, you were CIA counterterrorism from 76 to 1992, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So you really missed out on the whole fun and games with Ramzi Youssef and all that.
Well, actually, the counterterrorism craft was not really that well developed in CIA. By the time I got out, it really became a much more important part of the agency afterwards.
And you also did a short stint as a contractor in 2001, right? Can you tell me anything about that?
Well, basically, I was working at the agency as a contractor, again, in the counterterrorism area. I was there when 9/11 happened.
Oh, so you were already working there?
Right.
Oh, that's very interesting. Can you tell us anything about what happened that morning at CIA? You were at the building in Langley that day, or?
I was, and there was a major panic there were televisions on, obviously, in the building, and they showed the World Trade Center going down, and instructions came through to evacuate the building, so everyone had to get out and go into the parking lot, and there was a major panic.
You know, there are a lot of people that day who point to CIA drill. Sorry, I forget the name of it. But apparently there was a drill going on that morning about what would happen if there were multiple hijackings and such.
Well, from what I heard, it was a tabletop type exercise. It didn't involve the whole building. It didn't involve all the personnel. It was just an exercise that was being run by the Counterterrorism Center. And it basically went, you know how a tabletop exercise works. It's basically a paper exercise that you run through various scenarios, and you make decisions at various points in the scenarios, and you see how it all comes out.
Do you see any indication that drill in any way interfered with the response, that maybe people thought that what was happening was just part of the drill and not real world?
No, I don't think so, because obviously the real world situation was very clear, and the exercise was an exercise. It's I don't think it changed any of the responses. There was a strong feeling at the time that the CIA headquarters would be one of the targets of one of the airplanes, and that's why they evacuated.
Well, sure. Ramzi Youssef's laptop computer said that way back in 1995, right?
Sure. It's an obvious target, just as the White House was an obvious target, and that's, you know, that's as far as you should go with that. It really there are certain obvious targets, Pentagon being one, which was hit, and the CIA headquarters obviously was one also.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Philip Giraldi from the American Conservative magazine and Canestraro Associates, talking about 9/11 and all kinds of other subjects. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Yeah.
friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Philip Giraldi, former CIA counterterrorism officer, who writes for the American Conservative magazine. So where we left off, we were talking about you were at CIA as a contract employee. Is that on the analyst side or on the covert side, or can you say?
It was on the covert side.
On the covert side, and that's in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were there to witness firsthand the government's reaction to September 11th then?
Well, at least part of the government reaction, yeah, certainly what was going on at the agency.
There are lots of questions about the disaster in Afghanistan where thousands of innocent people were killed and, of course, obviously some al-Qaeda people, the Arab Afghans, were captured. And yet Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and Mullah Omar, and all those got away.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a very interesting story by Seymour Hersh called The Getaway
mm-hmm.
that says that Bush basically made the compromise and let the Pakistanis airlift all of the guys we were chasing out of Kunduz, I believe it was.
Well, I think the story that Seymour had was basically that a lot of the Taliban were able to get out that way. Osama bin Laden and a lot of his people managed to get out of Tora Bora through the bungling of the United States Army, and also by virtue of the fact that the Pakistanis were supposed to seal the border, which they didn't do.
And why was it that the job was, quote-unquote, outsourced to the Northern Alliance? Was it because they were already working on sending the army to Iraq and they didn't want to bother?
I don't think that's the case. I suspect that it was just basically a reluctance to have American casualties, and they really thought they could outsource it. That was a very bad decision.
They're really reluctant to have American casualties in the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
Right. It's, again, a very bad decision, but I think that's what essentially was motivating our military. And Seymour Hersh also reported that there were a number of incidents leading up to that in which the 10th Mountain Division and other supposedly elite troops did not perform that well. So there were practical considerations, too.
You know, Michael Scheuer, who I'm sure you're familiar with,
yes.
Author of Imperial Hubris, he's written that there are fewer analysts and covert operators working in the bin Laden unit now than before September 11th.
Well, he's the expert on that. That's where he worked. So if he says that's true, I believe what he's saying is correct.
Can you make any sense of that at all? I mean, there must be some sort of rational explanation. No?
Well, I think it's probably that when you have limited resources, you respond to what are perceived as the threats that the White House is laying out for you. And there was a definite shift in gears after the successful invasion of Afghanistan towards Iraq. And I think that's basically what you're looking at here. Your resources were taken from one place and sent somewhere else.
And the picture is emerging more and more about why exactly Iraq was the top priority and not catching Osama bin Laden. It's a convergence of interests, I guess, for many different areas. But the one that has at least caught my attention more than the rest is the connection between the Israeli government, the Likud party particularly, Ariel Sharon's guys, and the neoconservatives in the Pentagon. I just finished a conversation with Karen Kotowski where she described escorting Israeli generals to Douglas Feith's office. We all know that Larry Franklin, a Pentagon Iran analyst, has been indicted for spying for Israel along with Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman at AIPAC. And only 3 weeks ago, I talked with Sabelle Edmonds, the most gagged American in history, and she described basically that the story, the bits and pieces of her story that we know about these so-called semi-legitimate organizations, gun running, drug running, money laundering. She says that all of her story is all tied in with the AIPAC story as well, that it's all just one big scandal. And basically, I'm hoping that you can help us make some sense out of this.
Well, the problem with Sybil's story is that, of course, the gag order makes it difficult for her to be explicit. I suspect that what she's saying, I read her transcript very carefully when you interviewed her, and I've seen a lot of other stuff that she's prepared. I suspect that what she's saying is that we're going to see a lot of the same players coming out when eventually when there are indictments in the AIPAC case, or when there are more indictments. There have been indictments, obviously, already. When there are more details that come out, we're going to see a lot of the same players coming out of Doug Feith's office and the Pentagon that were involved with AIPAC and also were involved with Iraq and have been involved with Chalabi and have been involved with a lot of other issues.
Right. Well, and we also know from Bob Dreyfus's reporting and also Julian Borger's that basically Ariel Sharon was having the same problem with the Mossad that Dick Cheney was having with the CIA, and that was they'd lie some, but not quite enough. And so apparently Sharon created his own little Office of Special Plans that was creating intelligence in English and passing it to the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon.
Yeah, it's funny how the Israelis are kind of copying everything the neocons are doing. They've also set something up that's like the American Enterprise Institute. So this is not too surprising. But yeah, I mean, basically, the intelligence officers who, to a certain extent, have been politicized, will look at evidence and say, well, this situation is basically true or it's not true. And that's as true in Israel as it is in the United States. And many intelligence officers saw that the lead-up to the war in Iraq in particular was bogus.
And so they wouldn't cooperate. And
well, some of them would and some of them wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, so do you think that, or I guess the question is, how large of a role do you think that Israel played in the run-up to war? Obviously, it wasn't all about them.
Right. I think you've got it right, just the way you phrased it. It wasn't all about them, but they were a major issue, an unspoken issue, in the war leading up. I mean, you can't discount the fact that people like Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl were in key policy-making positions at that time. And all these people are, one might argue, are closer to Israel on strategic issues than they are in terms of the United States national interest.
Well, and when you bring up Feith and Pearl, these are also names that are connected with Turkey and other Turkic countries.
And not just Turkey.
Calls them.
Yeah, and not just Turkey. Look at if you look at the people who were behind the Lebanese Get the Syrian Out movement. Look at the people who have been sponsors of that group over the last 20 or 30 years. The defining interest for these people, whether they want to verbalize it that way or not, is Israel, and their interest in Turkey is basically because they felt that Turkey was a country, given its own geostrategic interests, could be manipulated into a closer relationship with Israel. And they were correct.
And so I guess I hate to just go into rampant speculation, but Sabel seems to be implying that these same neoconservatives, particularly Douglas Feith and Richard Pearl, that they are the people involved in these international drug running and terrorism financing rings.
I think I wouldn't want to make that statement flatly because I don't have the facts to back that up. But I would point out that these people have a lot of financial interests in the region. You never meet a poor neoconservative. Doug Feith, for example, has a law office in Washington and a law office in Jerusalem. Richard Pearl has major financial stakes in Israeli defense contractors. So there is a lot of overlap in terms of where these people are and how they get their money. And some of this money is definitely dirty. It's money that is basically involved in, let's not talk about drugs, but let's talk about weapon sales. A lot of American technology has been exported illegally by the Israelis, has been turned into weapons that they then sell to countries that are basically our enemies.
Sure. Happened with China not long ago.
Absolutely. China is the best case. And also there have been a lot of technology sales to India.
Well, and let's talk about drugs, too, because Al-Qaeda gets, according to Loretta Napoleone, who did a great book about the economics of terrorism, she says that they get the vast majority of their financing from selling opium products to Europeans and Americans.
Well, I mean, that certainly was true. I'm not so sure it's as true anymore as it was at one time, because a lot of these channels have been cut off. But yeah, I mean, when you're basically geographically situated in a part of the world where drug production is the major industry, you get involved in it in various ways, and because you need the money.
Sure, and you know, there's the whole Kevin Bacon game thing here where degrees of separation, when you're dealing with a handful of elite, powerful people who run things all over the world, it's not surprising that you come up with the same names over and over again, and it doesn't always indicate, you know, complicity and knowledge and that kind of thing. However, you know, if you just look at a map of Asia, you can basically, you know, trace a pretty good route through the Golden Crescent, northern Afghanistan, and the other Stan brothers there, through Turkey and through the Balkans.
Right.
We know that the Kosovo Liberation Army, who America fought on the side of in 1999, that they're a big part of the heroin running. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And, of course, a lot of this stuff, this stuff is basically, you know, it's being produced in Afghanistan increasingly. The Taliban had more or less stamped it out. It's being produced in Afghanistan. It then goes to the Central Asian, the stands, where essentially it gets into the hands of local, very often Islamic groups, strangely enough, terrorist-type groups, who then connect with the Russian gangs that get it into Eastern Europe. And in Eastern Europe, it goes to people like in Kosovo, that where eventually gets into the markets in Western Europe and the United States.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Philip Giraldi from the American Conservative Magazine. We'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Philip Giraldi, former DIA and CIA man, Canestraro Associates, and writes for the American Conservative Magazine. And we're talking about the different criminal investigations, basically going on, criminal investigations into the behavior of the executive branch of the Bush government. And, you know, Bill Clinton had a scandal a day, it seems. In the 1990s, there was somebody's in his cabinet being indicted, or a special prosecutor being appointed, or some house full of kiddos burning down or something, but they were all sort of separate. In the Bush years, it seems like all of the different crimes committed by this White House all sort of come back to the same little group of Pentagon neocons. These are the guys who lied us into war. Apparently they're the ones who leaked the name of Valerie Plame. They're the guy who hired Ahmed Chalabi and all of the lies of the Iraqi National Congress. They drew up the plans for the occupation of Iraq. They're responsible, at least in part, some way connected with the Niger uranium forgeries. Obviously, Larry Franklin, who worked in the Office of Special Plans, has now been indicted as a spy for Israel and is about to go on trial. What am I missing here?
Well, I think you're pointing out the obvious, which is that the Republicans are more disciplined than the Democrats, so everything is more focused.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's funny coincidence. When Waco was burning, Bill Clinton was sitting on the couch with John Wong and Johnny Chung.
Mm-hmm.
Just coincidentally, they happened to be there that day, according to the logs. You know, but
yeah,
that's
yeah.
As close as his scandals get together, though. Just coincidences, you know.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think the scandals under Clinton were of a different nature. I think that the serious point you're making about the nature of the Bush scandals is that these are people actually who drove us to war in terms of their lying, in terms of their manipulation of the system. And that's a much higher order of magnitude than Bill Clinton and his sexual peccadilloes.
Well, last time I interviewed you, I got you to give me a mm-hmm on Michael Ledeen as being the origin of the forged Niger uranium documents. You said two former CIA officers also associated with that region of the world, working with Michael Ledeen, were the ones who forged those documents, right?
Well, I gave you an uh-huh. I'll give you another uh-huh.
Okay. So I guess I'm not going to be able to get the names of the former CIA officers off of you then?
No, but I'll elaborate a little bit on what I was hinting at that time, which is that these people did it probably for a couple of reasons. But one of the reasons was that these people were involved through the neoconservatives with the Iraqi National Congress and Chalabi, and had a financial interest in cranking up the pressure against Saddam Hussein and potentially going to war with him.
Wow, so if Patrick Fitzgerald is listening, there's a money trail for you to follow out there, bud.
I think Patrick Fitzgerald has already found the money trail. It's just, I think, a question at this point when these documents will become public, and then you'll see all these names and you'll see how basically the all these things happened.
Now, one thing that keeps coming up over and over again when I look back through the history of stovepiped intelligence over the last few decades is the name Michael Ledeen, not just in the case of these Niger forgeries, but even going back to Team B and lying about Russian power and Russian ties with terrorism. Wasn't there a whole conspiracy theory in the 80s about how the Soviet Union was behind every terrorist group in the Middle East?
Yeah, well, you know, the point is that people, since Ronald Reagan has been beatified, people forget that a lot of these loonies actually got into government under Reagan, and Ledeen was certainly one of them.
And now Bob Woodward, in his book Veil, which, not that Woodward's my favorite source of information, but he basically talks about this. It's very reminiscent, really, of the war against Iraq, where there's this echo chamber where one group of kind of a rump intelligence unit like the Office of Special Plans, they say, hey, the Soviets are behind these terrorism groups, and then other neocons in the media repeat it and call for comment, and the White House says, oh, yeah, well, we just read that in the paper today, so it's true, and you get this echo chamber going back and forth,
yeah.
And it's all lies.
Well, of course it's all lies, and it always was all lies, and these people, you know, basically they weren't, of course, neocons back in at that time, but they were Scoop Jacksonites, basically, and that's where they came out of, Richard Pearl and all these others. And they were already kind of creating the neocon revolution in terms of being able to manipulate the system by basically working inside the government and also having people who were friends of theirs in the media in particular that would kind of, as you say, create a kind of echo chamber effect on these things that were not true.
And now Michael Ledeen was also involved in Iran-Contra, right?
Right, yep, and with Gorbani Farr and others. The Ledeen's involvement in a lot of these things is well documented and is out there in the press. How Ledeen is considered to be credible by anybody, and how he enjoys his tenure there at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a senior fellow, isn't he?
Yeah.
Amazes me. I mean, the guy is clearly very smart but delusional.
Well, now, when I'm reading reports in the newspaper of Iranian defectors giving intelligence, should I go ahead and just presume that this is lies coming through Gorbanifar and Ledeen's buddies?
I would absolutely presume it's the same game that was played by Chalabi with the Iraqi National Congress. It's exactly the same, and it's exactly the same kind of manipulation.
All right, everybody, we'll be right back with Philip Giraldi. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and if you don't like it, you can just leave the country, pal. Oh, I'm sorry. I get that in my email every single day. Starts sinking into my brain. I'm talking with Philip Giraldi, former CIA counterterrorism officer, partner in Canestraro Associates. He writes Deep Background for the American Conservative magazine. And I'd like to get your perspective, sir, about the different splits within foreign policy circles in New York City and Washington, D.C. Now, there's a lot to indicate that George Bush Sr.'s men, Brent Scowcroft, Lawrence Eagleburger, Henry Kissinger even, a lot of the old Rockefeller Republican types opposed the war in Iraq, and at least publicly were very split from the neoconservatives. And yet, as I look through particularly in terms of Russia, for example, the Committee for Peace in Chechnya is full which means for aggression against Russia, is full of neoconservatives. Like nearly every single person who ever was an ex-Trotskyite turned right-wing warmonger is a member of this group. But so also are a lot of the so-called realists, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, and I believe Brent Scowcroft is also part of it. And when I talked with Sibel Edmonds, I quoted out of the Vanity Fair piece about her where they said that they couldn't find anything to indicate that Brent Scowcroft had anything to do with the kind of crime that she was talking about. And when I said that to her, she said, well, as far as they know from the one source they talked to. So she wouldn't accuse him, obviously, with her gag order, but she was not so quick to let Scowcroft off the hook of being involved with all this very same activity. So I'm basically trying to find lines to draw between some of these factions in D.C., and I don't really know where to put them.
Let me put it this way. Brent Scowcroft is a wealthy man, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Look, all these people have equities in the think tanks and in places like Carlyle Group and everything like that that they make money off of. Scowcroft, in fact, heads his own group. And these people are dependent on relationships. And these relationships cross the neocon realist line. And so many of these people, Scowcroft was very vocal in his opposition to the Iraq War. But there are other areas where he has communities of interest and he has sources of income that basically make him want to be accommodating with the other guys. And that's what it's all about. Everything in Washington is money. Money has corrupted the entire process. It's, what was it, Diogenes with his lamp looking for an honest man? Well, he would have a lot of trouble in Washington.
Yeah, there's not too many.
Mm-hmm.
I got to spend last weekend, that's why I wasn't here, everybody. I was at Ron Paul's barbecue. There's an honest man in Washington, D.C.
He's the only one.
Yeah, well, I wish I could talk to Sibel Edmonds without her gag order. I really want to understand more of the depth of detail in these international money laundering and drug running and gun running rings.
I think what essentially she's saying is that a lot of these people are players across the board, and that a lot of this money comes from common sources, some of which are shady. I don't know that for a fact because I she has a gag order, but I suspect that's what it is. And, all these people have gotten rich off of being in government, and all these people have played their separate games. And when they're striking a I am a man of integrity pose, that's when you begin to hold your nose.
Right. Well, and, Sibel Edmonds, she's always the one to bring it up. When I talked to her, I was going to get to it. It was on my piece of paper. But she wanted to make sure that we got to the part where she could say this is all tied into September 11th.
Yeah.
Basically implying, if not direct complicity, that at least these same money laundering rings were the ones who financed the attacks.
Well, that could be. If she's saying that or suggesting that, she's obviously well-placed to know that, and it's probably true.
It's very interesting stuff. All right, well, and speaking of September 11th, there's big news today, or this week, about the Israeli art students. There's a corporate lawyer named Gerald M. Shea, who's written quite a lengthy dossier on the Israeli art students, the intelligence operation that was underway in the United States prior to September 11th, and the movement of the hijackers. And I think he leaves little doubt that the Israeli spies actually were following the September 11th hijackers around this country in the months prior to that attack. Is that your understanding, sir?
Well, they were following some of the September 11th hijackers, and they were also following a large number of other Arabs. It was a very big operation that was directed against what they saw as radical Arabs living in the United States.
What does it have to do with the DEA?
What they were doing was they were trying to develop contacts within the DEA among other organizations. They also, it's my understanding, also went after some other senior Justice Department people and also went after some people who were in local law enforcement. The idea was to get at people who had access to the basic criminal justice database on people in the United States. So if you're an Israeli and you're trying to find out about Arabs in the United States, you want to get access to the information that's going to be able to tell you where they're living, what they're doing, and so on and so forth. To do that, you have to go through basically a contact with an official who has access to that information.
Now, dozens of these people were deported after September 11th, right?
More than a dozen, I believe. I think a figure well over 100.
And so I guess that would indicate that the FBI was not in on this investigation with the Israelis.
No, the Israelis were running a unilateral operation. This was in violation of bilateral agreements with the United States saying that they wouldn't do that sort of thing. And also the bilateral agreement stipulated that the United States and Israel would only enter these kinds of operations if all the information was shared. So they were violating it in several senses. They were running unilateral operations. They were going, there was a whole, my understanding is that there was a whole spate of incidents all around the world, not just in the United States, in which the Israelis were very aggressively going after American officials and trying to get into classified installations like nuclear power plants.
Oh, really? And not just in the United States, but all around the world in that same time frame?
Yeah, all around the world. There were a bunch of incidents in embassies in Europe and Asia where Israelis were aggressively trying to make contact with embassy officials and intelligence officials, and also in some cases were actually trying to physically to get into the installations themselves.
Well, now, didn't Israel give the United States a warning that there was some sort of impending attack?
No.
Not at all?
Not. My understanding is no.
Oh, because I thought they at least had warned that they didn't have anything specific, but they thought there might be an attack overseas or something like that.
Oh, okay. Israel and the United States constantly exchange information, and it's quite possible that they gave information saying that, in general terms, there might be an attack somewhere, but that's not the same as giving information that suggests that there's going to be a specific type of attack.
Right, and they sure didn't say, hey, here's this cell of people we've been following around Hollywood, Florida for 6 months.
No, they did not.
And, you know, obviously, I hate to, speculate and ascribe motives where I can't know them, but it really would not be in Israel's strategic interest to warn America about an impending attack, would it?
Israel's interest at that time would have been to possibly look the other way if there were a terrorist attack in the United States, because that would have made the United States closer to Israel in terms of counterterrorism policy. You have to understand that Israel has for a long time been playing the game of convincing the United States in particular and the Europeans also that groups like Hamas are terrorist groups, international terrorist groups. The reality is, of course, these groups are not. They're resistance groups, pretty much, that exist only to oppose the Israeli occupation. So Israel has been doing a sell job in terms of what constitutes an international terrorist. So it was very much in their interest to have an attack on the United States, which would push the United States closer to their position.
And which we have moved quite a bit closer to that position. We didn't declare a war on Al-Qaeda. We declared a war on terror.
Right. And you might notice what John Bolton is doing at the UN right now. He's trying to get the language rewritten on what defines a terrorist for the United Nations, to make it so that national resistance organizations like Hamas will no longer be considered that and will be considered terrorists. So this is a sustained campaign to do this sort of thing, and it's sustained and being carried out even today.
So this new definition will basically have any armed resistance to a state on Earth will have to be considered terrorism?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Well, so that makes George Washington and Alexander Hamilton terrorists too, right?
Exactly. They would have been hung by John Bolton's definition.
Right. It's my favorite kind of patriotism, the kind of people who nowadays would be fighting on the side of the king.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and not just terrorism policy here, but Iraq policy specifically, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have the Clean Break memo that was written for Benjamin Netanyahu in 1996, sure indicates that the neoconservatives had Israel's interests in mind in their plans for the removal of Saddam Hussein.
Well, you know, it's like in the mind of I occasionally talk to neocons with some distaste, But in their minds, there is no difference between Likud, Israel, strategic policies, and U.S. strategic policies. So they've fudged this whole issue in their minds, and I think many of them honestly believe it. It's like back in the 50s, if you recall, there used to be the saying that what's good for General Motors is good for the United States. Well, you know, just as that was not true, also the view that Israel and the United States basically have the same interest in the region and worldwide is ridiculous.
Well, and how so? How is it that the war on terrorism as it's being fought now is not, which is obviously a very Israeli-centric policy, how would we fight it if we weren't so interconnected with Israel on this issue?
Well, first of all, I mean, we're only in it probably because of our connection with Israel. I mean, if you go back far enough, obviously America's involvement in the Middle East and the nature of the involvement has largely been something that's been dictated by friends of Israel in both Democratic and Republican administrations. So to a certain extent, we're in there because of that. The United States basically only got involved in Iraq for bad reasons, and one of the real bad reasons was Israel. So we wouldn't be there, and we wouldn't be having created a magnet for terrorists worldwide who are now focusing on us as the primary problem.
Now, are you referring back to the original war in 1991 as well?
No, I'm referring to the more recent war. I think that the war back in 91 was justified. Saddam Hussein, although he had some good historical reasons for doing what he did, was basically an aggressor, and I felt that the United States had a strategic interest to get in there to beat him and then get out.
Did April Glaspie, the American ambassador, not basically give him the green light to go ahead and invade Kuwait?
Yeah, she did. And then, again, as I say, there was a lot of ambiguity about the message that she sent, but I think that if you look at it, you would probably say that she did give him a green light, no question about it.
Phil, are you familiar with a neoconservative by the name of Edward Luttwak?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now I apologize because I don't remember specifically the exact source. I know that there's a brand new book coming out called Neocond, and in the second book of Neocond, there's an essay by, I believe it's Stephen something, I can't remember his name, but he talked about a conversation that he had with Edward Luttwak in 1990 during the build-up Desert Shield in preparation for the first Gulf War, and that Luttwak explained that the reason we were doing that back then was for Israel, that because the Iran-Iraq War was over, Saddam Hussein was about to be able to successfully pay off his war debts to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and then he was going to build a strong Arab state. And the Israelis were not going to have that, and so they needed us to come in there and smash Iraq into a million pieces for them. When you look at the policy as it's going down now, with the Israelis doing everything they can to keep Kurdistan independent as the Iranians run off with the South, is this not all an Israeli agenda to weaken the largest Arab state?
Well, look, I mean, if you were a little country like Israel and you use a big country, powerful country like the United States to take out your enemies one by one, you would do it. I would have to see the Luttwak comment in context, because Luttwak is an ardent advocate of Israel and has basically in his writing justified everything and anything that the Israelis do against the Palestinians or anybody else. So I would be careful about, you know, exactly, you know, consigning motives to Luttwak. Bear in mind that in 91, even then, the Israelis probably would have seen Iran as ultimately their biggest problem in the region. And I'm not so sure they would have been in a position to manipulate. They could not have manipulated Saddam Hussein doing something as stupid as invading Kuwait.
Right. Well, but if their partisans in the United States wanted to advance this plan, giving him the green light to go ahead and invade and then having a great excuse to go in there and drive him out.
Oh, I see.
Pretty convenient.
Okay. I think that's far-fetched. I think that, you know, that actually the what we saw in at that time was a confused American policy, because we had also just recently gone through the problems with Iran and with the takeover of the embassy and everything like that. So Iran was we were in bed with Saddam to a certain extent because of Iran. I think it gets a little bit too convoluted and a little bit to, you know, kind of looking at the stars and wondering what's up there when you consign motives that are kind of implausible.
Right. I mean, I guess we'd have to know what influence Lutwak had in the Bush administration.
I don't think he had a whole lot of it. He's an academic, basically.
Right. Well, and also we have the fact that basically Thatcher called Bush out as a coward right there on TV. Don't go wobbly, Bush. So he had to give a strong answer, right?
Yeah, I think there's some of that, too. So, I mean, the thing is, even like the current Iraqi situation we're talking about, is it Israel, is it this? Well, there are a lot of motives that come together to let these situations develop. And don't discount the military-industrial complex as a major player, Halliburton and all these other people in all these things. And that was true back in the 90s, early 90s, too. So take a grain of salt when you're looking at these things, and don't look for a single motive. Look for a lot of different motives.
Right. It's the convergence where they all come together.
Right.
It's where the war comes.
Exactly.
Okay, now, on Ahmed Chalabi, you know, when we look at the situation in Iran right now where, you know, Prime Minister Jafari only, I guess, a month and a half ago or so went and laid a wreath at the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini and made all kinds of different agreements with the Iranians. I guess, well, we're going to have to go out to this break. But when we get back from this break, I want to know whether you think Chalabi was planning on the situation the way it is now, whether he was deliberately fooling the rest of the neoconservatives, or whether their plans just got messed up. I'm talking with Philip Giraldi on the Weekend Interview Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives there. And I'm wrapping up my donation drive, so if anybody wants to go and help out a little bit, you can go to weekendinterviewshow.com and click on the PayPal link there. And we're wrapping up this interview here with Philip Giraldi. He writes the Intelligence Brief with Vincent Canestraro and writes Deep Background for the American Conservative magazine, former DIA and CIA officer. And speaking of DIA and CIA, both now say that Ahmed Chalabi was not just passing American secrets to Iran, but was in fact passing Iranian lies about Iraq to America in the run-up to the war against Iraq. Is that your understanding, sir?
Yeah, it's my understanding that both intelligence agencies believe that Chalabi actually was an agent, in effect, of the Iranian intelligence service.
And isn't that interesting? Because, you know, he's an original neocon. He went to the University of Chicago, studied under Leo Strauss. He goes back years and years with Pearl and Wolfowitz and the rest of these guys.
Well, I went to the University of Chicago, too, so don't blame us all for that.
Well, but you didn't study under Leo Strauss, did you?
No, I didn't.
You noble liar, you.
But anyway, Chalabi is I think, to a certain extent, the puppet master on a lot of this stuff. He's a... I think the last time you and I talked, I said that he was basically out for Chalabi, and I think that I wouldn't deviate from that view. He's manipulated certain situations and certain organizations, and he's a realist. He understands the real power in that area is Iran and the Shiite connection. So he's not going to necessarily be that close to his Pentagon handlers when he sees that the real power is somewhere else.
So all the while that he's promising the neoconservatives that they're going to get this water pipeline to Haifa and
right.
They're going to have a Hashemite king and everything, or you know, Chalabi himself, and Iraq's going to be this great democracy. At the same time he's telling them all that, he knows that Skiri and the Dawa party are going to end up ruling Iraq, and he's basically planning on it.
Sure. And he basically is trying to position himself to be kind of in the middle, somebody who's friendly to everybody, somebody who is a proven manipulator. There's a lot of, bear in mind, there's a lot of corruption of all kinds in Iraq, too. A lot of which we allowed to develop with the provisional authority that we were running. And someone like Chalabi is well positioned to benefit from that kind of middleman position.
Absolutely. So the winners here, then, if I can count them off on my list, the Ayatollah Khomeini, he's got a giant new province in southern Iraq. Israel now has the big, strong Arab state smashed in at least three pieces, if not more than that. We'll see how it works out. Al-Qaeda recruitment has soared through the roof, according to every intelligence agency on Earth. I think even the neocons admit that. And so I guess America and the people of Iraq, we come in last place.
Well, I think so, yeah. The people of Iraq were never a major beneficiary of any of this. And the United States is going to find itself, I think, in a position where we don't have leverage with anybody. And Israel is going to turn out, I think, to be a loser, too, because basically all we're going to see is a stronger Iran, in fact. And I think the Israeli intelligence service was kind of warning that the way it was going.
So then that brings up the question, then, if Bush is backed into a corner, he's basically got nothing left to do but lash out and exit strategy through Iran, right? We can't let them get away with taking half Iraq, can we?
Well, I don't know what options we have. I mean, we don't have a military option apart from bombing them. And I'm not sure we have other options to play. I think that's the true desperate kind of end game that we're going to wind up with in Iraq. And I think we'll see that play out over the next 6 months to a year.
I'm really worried, honestly, that Bush is going to feel so cornered. I mean, it's a guy who does everything from his gut. He's going to feel so cornered that he's just going to take one last chance for greatness.
Well, I think that he has so many problems with what's going on in Louisiana right now. I think that his options will be rather constrained.
All right. Thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Giraldi. I sure appreciate it.
Quite all right. I enjoyed it.